Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What do American achievements in art, literature, medicine, and civil rights of the 19th century owe to the challenges, charms, and wonders of Paris? While today there are daily direct flights between major U.S. cities and the French capital, the men and women who traveled there between 1830 and 1900 faced a much less comfortable and, frankly, more dangerous crossing. But as my guest today will explain, American scientists, painters, writers, and even doctors who visited during that time discovered ideas and practices that would revolutionize the fields they worked in and inspire their individual contributions. Multiple Pulitzer Prize-winning author David McCullough tells their stories in his new book, The Greater Journey, Americans in Paris. David, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Glad to be here. Glad to be back in Texas.
And I'm excited to have you when you are. Can we talk about this publicly, the big news that you had today?
Sure.
Number one on the New York Times bestseller list.
The Sunday after this, not this coming Sunday. Coming Sunday is going to be number three. Next week is number one.
So you're building up to the big moment.
So that's thrilling and very gratifying because without becoming specific, there were some people who questioned whether my departure to do a subject of this kind would not have the readership that my prior books did, which were focused on traditional historic American historic subjects like John Adams or the building of the Brooklyn Bridge. But this is a book I've wanted to write for a long time because, among other things, it's expressing an attitude of mine toward history about how it ought to be perceived and how it ought to be written and how it ought to be taught, and that is that its history is much more than just politics and the military. It's about people. History is human, and a big part of the human experience, and including the American experience, is the whole realm of ideas and art and music and science and theater and opera and so forth. And in some ways, it's often more important than the politics of the day or the social issues of the day, and it can last longer. There are, as you know, ancient civilizations. All we know about them is their art. So that a George Gershwin or a Mark Twain or a Willa Cather or an Ella Fitzgerald may be part of the human experience 200, 300, 500 years from now, whereas most of the people we take to be so very important today are long, long forgotten.
You're a painter yourself. Do you remember the first time that you walked into the Louvre?
Indeed, I do. And I remember vividly the first time that I arrived in Paris, mm-hmm. which was 50 years ago this year. I was on my way with my wife, Rosalie, on a tour of the Middle East because I was with the U.S. Information Agency then. We were still in our 20s, and we were heading for Morocco, but we went by way of Paris, and we arrived there for the first time in our lives on a February night. It was rainy, dark, cold, and we got to the hotel. We put our bags in the room and went out and walked for about 2 or 3 hours in the most atrocious weather imaginable, and it didn't matter at all. We were in Paris.
And that setting out on foot as soon as they arrived, I mean, people still do that today, and people were doing that in the 19th century as well. They would sort of get to where they were staying and then get out there on foot.
Well, Paris is a city wherein you have to walk to really see it, and you want to walk. And you find yourself walking much farther than you ever imagined. And because one vista leads to another, one long perspective or one marvelous building or whatever it might be, just pulls you along the way. And to do it in all seasons, at all times of day, is just part of being there. People say to me, how should we approach Paris? What should we do? I said, just take it slowly, the way you would sip a good wine. Don't try to gulp it down. And you don't have to see it all. You can see it all over several visits, but enjoy it. Sit in the park. Watch the children. Take your time having a lovely afternoon in a sidewalk cafe. And that's part of the whole French secret to life. The joie de vivre is not just singing and dancing. It's savoring life and savoring what human beings can do to create environments. There's nothing intrinsically beautiful about Paris. There's a river and there's some hills, but there's no snow-capped mountain range in the distance. There's no beautiful shoreline to gaze on. It's how the spaces have been organized, the open spaces, the architecture. It's about light, color, and architecture. And of course, it's also about history, and you feel that very powerfully because so much of what you're looking at, so much of literally the ground you're walking on, is so old.
So old and has seen so much amazing sort of action. I think one of the more interesting chapters for me, and I don't know if I'm going to pronounce this right, was about the U.S. diplomat Elihu Washburn.
That's right.
Who was there. He stayed in Paris throughout the Franco-Prussian War. He was there throughout the commune uprising that followed. First of all, why did he stay in Paris when every other diplomat in his right mind took off?
He stayed. First of all, he stayed because he felt he had to. It was his duty, not just as the ambassador, but as a human being. If there are still Americans caught in the city was under siege, surrounded by the Germans, and the Germans were going to starve it out, starve it into surrendering. Mm-hmm. And there were only about 150 Americans still there, but he stayed, and he performed heroic service during that time. For example, this is a little-known story, which could have been the whole subject of an essay or a movie or a play or in itself, a novel. There were over 20,000 Germans living in Paris, mostly all uneducated, very poor people who were street sweepers and laundresses. They did the work that others didn't want to do. And when the war came and they were suddenly caught in Paris, their lives were in very serious jeopardy because they could be and were in some cases taken away, suspected of being spies, and shot mm-hmm. without trial. So Washburn, at the urging of both the French and the German governments, organized an exodus of these unwanted people whose lives were hanging in the balance out of the country. 20,000 people or more, he succeeded in getting out, saving their lives, saving whole families. And there was nothing in his contract, as it were, that required him to do that. He didn't even have to be there. But he did it and succeeded. And after the siege of Paris was over, when the city finally did surrender, then a violent, bloody, really horrific civil war broke out called the Commune, in which the City of Light, the ultimate example of sophistication and civilization, art and music, had a convulsion which revealed the worst possible sides of human depravity, in which thousands more were slaughtered, atrocities of the worst kind committed, women, children. And he stayed through all of that, trying as best he could, among other things, to rescue the Archbishop of Paris, Archbishop Darboy, the highest French priest in the city, from being executed by the Communards, the people who had taken over the city. And he wasn't a Roman Catholic, and he wasn't French, and that wasn't his job, but he was a human being with a strong conscience of right and wrong. And he was determined to save that man's life. And he went again and again to be with him in his prison cell, failed to stop the execution, but nobody tried harder, and all to his great credit. And on top of all that, he kept a diary through the whole horrible time.
And you found the
original.
Every
single day. Yes, we did. I say we because I have a wonderful research assistant who's worked with me for years, Mike Hill. A copy of the original was in the Library of Congress, but the Library of Congress didn't even realize it because it had been bound by somebody in several volumes, mixed in, broken up and mixed in with letters. So it would have seemed to be a collection of what were called letterpress copies of letters. Once we had the letterpress copy of these diary entries, we realized there had to be a real one somewhere, and that, it turned out, was up in Livermore, Maine, a little town on the western border of Maine, right on the New Hampshire line, where the family had originally come from.
This is going to sound like a not important question, but I think about when you're looking at original documents, have you gotten to be very good at reading the handwriting of people who put everything down in longhand?
I'm pretty good. Mm-hmm. For one thing, handwriting was considered a mark of one's education, and particularly the mark of a gentleman. Mm-hmm. And bad handwriting was not to be acceptable. I was raised that way. My father, your handwriting is not as good as it needs to be. And there really were bugs about that. Also, everybody was expected to write letters. It wasn't just something you might do. You were required to write a letter, and particularly to your parents if you were away at college, or even more dramatic, if you were away studying at the Sorbonne, let's say, across the ocean in Paris. So the reason I was able to write about all these people is that they wrote home what was happening to, or they kept diaries. Now, today, very few people write letters at all, and nobody in public life dares keep a diary anymore. I really honestly don't know how future historians are going to write about us. But the difficult handwriting is difficult, and it often fades, which makes it even more difficult. My research assistant, Mike Hill, is very good at that, much better than I am. So I leave a lot of that to him. And he makes transcriptions of all of it for me.
When you read these letters and these diaries, obviously there's a lot of passion that comes through, and yet people describe things in different ways than they might today. Can you talk about, like with Washburn, how much emotion sort of bleeds through his accounting of what's taking place?
Well, there's a great deal of emotion because the diary entries are very different from his official correspondence back to Washington, all of which is available through the National Archives. And if he really doesn't like somebody, or if he is worn out and depressed and discouraged, if he wonders whether he can maintain the strength to keep going, that would not appear in the official correspondence, but it's very, very apparent, very often fulsome in the diary. And it makes him a human being. You wonder how the man did what he did as it was, but to find out he did get down, he did get blue, he did get lonesome,
scared.
Missed his family, missed his home, desperately homesick. And very often people of that time were working their thoughts out on paper. They're trying to figure out how they feel. They're trying to decide whether this is the thing they really want to be doing and so forth. And some of them are explaining to their parents back home, who had a rather narrow vision of how life should be lived, that it was all right, mother and father, for me to go to the theater.
I'm not going to be corrupted.
And Oliver Wendell Holmes Sr. wrote this, and he said, you don't have to tear this part of the letter off. In other words, when you show it to your friends.
My guest this hour is Pulitzer Prize-winning author David McCullough. His newest book is called The Greater Journey, Americans in Paris. You can join the conversation now by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Pulitzer Prize-winning author David McCullough. His new book, The Greater Journey, Americans in Paris, is about to be number one on the New York Times bestseller list. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. David, one thing that sort of unifies all the characters in this book is that they go to Paris to learn. And maybe the greatest example of that is this, at the time, kid named George Healy. Can you tell us about him?
George Healy was a boy an Irish boy in Boston who had talent. He had no education to speak of. He quit school when he was about 13 years old. But he did have an ambition to excel. And by the way, there are 7 Healy paintings, portraits, hanging in the White House right now. There are 17 Healy portraits hanging in the National Portrait Gallery. 2 of the greatest portraits ever made of Abraham Lincoln were by Healy. Now, here's this kid who's setting off for Paris, and here's what he wrote. "I knew no one in France. I was utterly ignorant of the language. I did not know what I should do when once there. But I was not yet 21, and I had a great stock of courage and of inexperience, which is sometimes a big help, and a strong desire to be my very best." Now, they're ambitious not to get rich or to be famous or to be powerful, but to be their best in their chosen field. The doctors wanted to be the best doctors possible. The painters wanted to be the best at what they did. A man like Charles Sumner went over because he felt he didn't know enough to be in public life. And they all brought something back, either figuratively or literally. And some brought back things of dramatic consequence, like Samuel F. B. Morse, who went over as a painter because, as he said, "I need Paris to perfect my ability." But while he was there, had the idea for the telegraph.
He saw French people doing a semaphore.
That's exactly right. Visual semaphores from the tops of towers. And he thought, why couldn't that be done with electricity? And he not only invented the telegraph, but, of course, he invented the Morse code that made it possible to transmit messages. One of the most important and history-changing ideas, inventions of the 19th century, which, of course, was filled with such inventions, many of them by Americans, Edison with a light bulb and the telephone, all of that, which were to change Europe as much as they changed the United States. And when he went back, when Morse went back to Paris to secure a patent for his telegraph, he met Daguerre, who had invented photography, then called the daguerreotype, and with Daguerre's agreement, brought the idea, the process of photography, back to the United States and set up the first studio for taking photographic portraits ever in America. So he came home, in effect, with 3 benefits to our country. And the others did the same thing, only to a greater or lesser degree. The medical students all came home to transform the teaching of American medicine, because American medicine until then, this is before the Civil War, was woefully behind.
It was just provincial, essentially.
It was provincial. It was clodhopper medicine. Most of the doctors in the country had never been to medical school, and they had trained under people who'd never been to medical school. The use of cadavers was for dissecting purposes in training medical students was frowned upon or illegal. In this country, most women would have preferred to die rather than have a man examine their body. And since all doctors were men, that meant women died by the thousands, tragically, needlessly. In Paris, there was no stigma about women being examined by doctors, men. And there was no stigma about the use of cadavers. So all these students got to make the rounds with – and students didn't make the rounds in hospitals in this country. They got to make the rounds with hospitals looking at a multitude of diseases and problems and all human beings, not just men. And they spent hours upon hours exhausting unpleasant hours dissecting bodies in the big laboratory or auditorium where they all did that. And it's pretty gruesome stuff when you read about it. But as they and difficult, but they'd signed on for a difficult profession, and far better to be experimenting on a dead arm than a living one.
And among those medical students was Elizabeth Blackwell.
Elizabeth Blackwell, I'm so taken with her. I just think she's terrific. She was the first American woman to become a doctor. And what she went through, the courage of that woman, Healy talks about courage in his little reminiscence about going over. In many ways, this book is about courage, the courage of these people to do what they did, the courage of Elizabeth Blackwell to become a physician and found the first hospital for women in this country, the courage of Mary Cassatt to become a painter, not a woman who paints, but a painter.
Yeah, because women in those days who painted were thought of as hobbyists and men were the artists.
Yes, and they were usually women of some financial means and society level, and this was something you did. My grandmother was a woman who painted, and she painted quite well. She could have very well been called an artist, but she was a woman who painted. But Mary Cassatt not only succeeded in becoming a painter, an artist, but she was the only American painter who was accepted by the Impressionist as an Impressionist. And she began coaching and advising her friend Mrs. Havemeyer about buying the Impressionist painter's works, because she said these are very important works. They're masterpieces. They're going to be of infinite importance and value in time to come. So the Havemeyer collection began to build, and it's now one of the great treasures of the Metropolitan Museum in New York. So that's another thing brought back. I feel so strongly that history is much more than politics and the military, and I feel so strongly that the lives of these people that we don't think of as part of history are among the greatest stories in the American experience. And I loved the chance to tell them. I've enjoyed every book I've written. I've never felt bogged down in a subject that I'd chosen. I've been very fortunate that way. But I have never had a better time. I've never felt I was writing from the heart more than in writing this book.
You mentioned earlier Charles Sumner, and I have to tell you, he's someone I had never heard of before, and I'm ashamed now to learn his story that I had never heard of him before, because he had a really amazing transformation. As you mentioned, he went over to Paris to study at the Sorbonne, and he saw something that he could not have even imagined possible in this country.
It was a moment that changed him, and it was a moment that changed our story, had changed history. It was an epiphany for him. Mm-hmm. He noticed that the black students at the Sorbonne dressed exactly the same as everybody else. They were treated exactly as everybody else. They acted like everybody else. And they had the same aspirations that he did. And he wrote in his journal, it's still right there, that maybe the way we feel about black people at home has to do with what we've been taught and is not part of the natural order of things. And he became an abolitionist and got into politics in Massachusetts, was elected to the United States Senate when he was still in his 40s, early 40s, and became the most powerful voice for abolition in Washington, and second only to Lincoln in importance at that time, nearly to the cost of his life, because he was attacked, blindsided by a Southern congressman with a heavy walking stick who was really about to beat him to death and nearly did.
My guest is David McCullough. His new book is called The Greater Journey, Americans in Paris. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also get to us by sending email to think@kera.org. We'll go to the phones now, and first we'll speak with Thomas in Dallas. Hi, Thomas.
Yeah, I'm not real good on especially this period of French history, but I take it this is right after Napoleon, and there's some disillusionment, whereas in America, England, I would say America too, we were under Victorianism, and sort of this retrenchment to, traditional values and things, and really starting to feel our own oats, especially more the British maybe than us at that time. But I'm a big fan of the British skeptics, which for an earlier time, And is this not a time of great irreverence in France, which is where I've, you know, where you challenge convention and really get development? Is that not accurate?
Well, the period I'm writing about is from 1830 to 1900, 70 years, about which a period of American involvement with education and learning and ideas that has been fairly ignored up until now. And it's a time not only of great change in this country, it's a time of often tumultuous change in Europe and particularly in Paris. Paris is subject to a political revolution during this period, and it's also subject to a total, what we would call, makeover under Napoleon III, wherein all the great boulevards and the trees and the expansion of the parks like the Bois de Boulogne and all that were done under the leadership of Baron Haussmann. And so the Americans who were there at the time saw all this happening. Keep in mind that this was a period when American cities, by contrast to Paris at that time, looked very small, very provincial, and were without such things as beautiful public parks or operas or theater of much of any consequence. And these Americans were not only discovering the majesty and uplifting presence of great architecture, they also discovering the fact that one needn't eat food that was mediocre all the time, and that they were in a place where wine was cheaper than milk. And all of these revelations for them not only didn't just change them with a sense of the possibilities in life, but would subsequently change us when they all came home. I don't think there's any question that we, the United States of America, benefited more from our associations with France than most Americans have any idea, be it the French involvement in our Revolutionary War, be it the doubling of the size of our country by the Louisiana Purchase, be it the presence in our very map of our country with French-named towns, French-named rivers, French-named colleges, universities, streets. It's all there. And in no other country but our own are more Americans buried than are buried in France, in the military cemeteries there. And if you've ever been there and seen them, you realize to what degree American history was transacted on the very ground of the French Republic.
Why, until this book, is there this huge gap? We know about, you know, Thomas Jefferson and Ben Franklin in Paris, and then we know about the Lost Generation. And then in between, we haven't paid that much attention.
I'm not sure I know the answer to that, but I'm very glad that we haven't, because it gave me the chance to work in a field where I was exploring, in some cases, for the first time. And very often, the people who have the most to say that is a benefit to us in understanding the primary characters or the times in which all these events are taking place are the secondary characters, the wife of someone like Augustus St. Gaudens, the great sculptor, or some of the others who worked in the embassy when Elihu Washburn was our minister there. The letters of people who didn't consider themselves writers mm-hmm. are superbly written. I don't just mean the handwriting, the use of the English language. It's humbling. When somebody like George Healy or Augustus St. Gaudens, who went to work when they were 13 years old, could write these superb letters, far better than we write letters today. And one of the great pleasures of this work was to read those letters, because you have to absorb at least 20 or 30 or 40 times more than what you use or what you write in your book. So as voluminous as what appears in the book in their own words may appear, it's only a fraction of the total. And I couldn't include everybody, otherwise it would become a catalog, not a book.
Yeah.
So therefore, I had to pick and choose which of these people best exemplified what they were there for and what it meant to us in the long run, but also which of these individuals were demonstrably changed by the experience. Now, someone like Winslow Homer, who was one of our greatest painters, went at a time when he was pretty well formed. And so I don't think he was, and others don't think either, he was greatly changed by the experience, and he didn't write much about it. So it would be very possible to tell his story. It's the stories of these people that I wanted to tell. And they are stories worth hearing. And I think, I hope, that what I've done will maybe open this field of 70-some years up and encourage others to take a look at it, too, because there's plenty more there.
Talk about James Fenimore Cooper, this quintessential American novelist who, in fact, wrote, was it 8 books in 7 years in Paris?
Yes. And the idea, and he's living in grand style in Paris. He's not in a garret up on the 5th floor somewhere on the left bank.
He wasn't George Healy's neighbor.
No, he was not. And the incongruity of this fellow living in the most sumptuous style in Paris, writing about the frontier of upstate New York in the 18th century is hard at first to understand. But it's perfectly understandable. In a way, I often think that a writer needs to step back from his subject, her subject, the way you have to step back from an Impressionist painting. If you stand right up in front of an Impressionist painting with your nose 6 inches away, it's all a blur. It's all, you can't make it out. But if you step back, either in time or space, step back 50 years, let's say, or step back and write the book about Texas when you're living in Massachusetts, or write the book about Paris when you're living in this country, it makes it easier to perceive what really matters and to perceive it in juxtaposition of the times in which it happened.
My guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning writer David McCullough. His new book, The Greater Journey, Americans in Paris, is out now. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is David McCullough. His new book is called The Greater Journey, Americans in Paris. By the way, if you are interested in a signed copy of the book, they are available at the Dallas Museum of Art gift store. The book itself is available elsewhere as well. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send email to think@kera.org. We have an email here from Lee, who wants to know if you would talk a bit about Henry Hobson Richardson.
H.H. Richardson, who is seen today as one of the most important American architects of the 19th century, was one of the earliest American students of architecture to study at the École des Beaux-Arts. And again, I have to emphasize, there were no schools of architecture in the United States. So if you want to really train as an architect, there was not much choice but to go to Europe, and the greatest school of architecture was in Paris. Richardson had a huge effect on American architecture, on American buildings. I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and the most outstanding building there is the old courthouse and jail by Richardson. They're massive. They're greatly influenced by the Romanesque, as he acknowledged. In Boston, where I live now, the famous Trinity Church on Copley Square is one of the landmarks not just of the city but of our country. And it is Richardson at his ultimate. And right across the square is the Boston Public Library, which was done by Charles McKim of McKim, Mead & White, who also trained at the École des Beaux-Arts. and who worked with Richardson as he was of younger generation when they were building Trinity Church, as did Stanford White, who was the best known of those architects at the time and a very important force in American architecture, as did Augustus St. Gaudens, the sculptor, as did John Lafarge, who was famous for his brilliant stained glass windows. All of them had been to Paris. And you can stand in the midst of Copley Square, in effect, say, you want to understand the influence of Paris and architectural training in Paris on America? Oh, you look no further. Here's the best show imaginable. And, in fact, the Boston Public Library is based in manner, in attitude toward the town, not literally in detail, as McKim acknowledged, is based on the Bibliothèque Saint-Geneviève in Paris, which is a great library. I'm very interested in architecture. I think it, in many ways, affects us, we human beings, more than we realize. It's like music. It's an art that's all around you, and we're shaped by it. Churchill talked about that. He said, we shape our buildings, and our buildings shape us. And we can never underestimate the importance of good architecture and good planning, good city planning, good use of landscape architecture in city planning. And all that's to be seen and learned from in Paris still today.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go back to the phones now, and this time we'll speak with Clark in Weatherford. Hi, Clark.
Hello, Mr. McCullough.
Yes, sir.
I'm so excited about this show. How are you going to keep them down on the farm after they've seen Paris, right?
That's the old song.
I've got this question about a woman named Edith Carvel, C-A-V-E-L-L, born in 1865, was shot to death by the Germans. She was a British nurse, a matron in a Brussels hospital in the First World War, and she was shot for giving aid to Allied prisoners. Have you heard about her?
No, I have not.
Okay, my grandmother, my maternal grandmother, was a volunteer Seventh-day Adventist nurse in Belgium and France in 1918 with her brother, who was a year younger than her, who was like a stretcher bearer. So, yeah. I'll just listen to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for your call. Well, I would imagine everywhere you go, people say, have you heard of? I mean, there must be people throwing ideas and interests
yes,
at you.
Yes, and I love it because mm-hmm. that's the way it ought to be. And as much has been written about the American story, American people, we've hardly scratched the surface. And new material comes to light all the time. We were just talking about the Washburn Diaries. So when students say, well, everything's been done, no, everything is far from done. There is a line at the door of people who deserve to be recognized, to be given credit where credit is long overdue. And if you go looking, you find. I've never had that fail in more than 40 years of this kind of work. You go digging into a subject, you'll find new material. And particularly if you talk to people.
Yeah, because as opposed to just reading a book.
Yes, or just talking to other historians mm-hmm. or just looking in libraries and archives. But talk to people just like the man who came on speak with us. Mm-hmm. You never know who knows something or who has something at home, up in the attic, or treasure that's come down through the family.
There are a lot of stories in the book that I feel like will stay with me and that I'll remember and tell to other people in a much hackneyed way compared with the text itself. But the thing that has stuck with me is this idea that I had never considered, that in the 19th century, you know, today if there's a great work of sculpture or a painting in the Louvre or anywhere else in the world, typically we can find an image of it online or at the very least find a book. At the time that these Americans were going over, they had perhaps heard of these works, but in many cases never seen even a reproduction of them.
No, and there was no reproduction in color at that point. Mm-hmm. Mostly it would be an engraving of the painting, sometimes very skillfully done. There were no photographs as yet until mm-hmm. Daguerre came along with his invention. So that to see them for the first time was a thrill. Now, when Morse went over, that very reason, when it began in a way with Jefferson, who when he left after 5 years as our representative in Paris, our minister to Paris, he brought home 83 crates, huge boxes, full of books and prints and paintings. He was trying to bring that world of culture and ideas back to his own country for the benefit of his own country, to bring us up to that level. And that's what many of these people want to do, Morse being a great example. He was going to do a painting of the inside of the Louvre, the interior of the Louvre, which no American had ever attempted, showing the masterpieces of the Louvre all hanging in one Salon Carré, the gallery, the Carré Gallery.
Just the challenge of that alone is extraordinary.
Unbelievable. Yeah. And he's got to not only give an accurate rendition of the painting, he's got to do it very well and catch the spirit of a Leonardo or a Titian. And so he, in effect, hung his choice of 30-some masterpieces in the Louvre, had to go and copy these paintings, which were very often hung very high.
Mm-hmm.
So he built this movable scaffold that went way up, about 12 feet. And he became a kind of tourist attraction in himself. People would come to see this American doing an immense painting, 6 by 9 feet, huge painting up there on the scaffold. And his friend James Fenimore Cooper, the writer, came to watch him and to encourage him and to kid him a little bit, which at first was just good fun and good entertainment for both of them. But then the horrible cholera epidemic, first ever to hit Europe, struck Paris, and people were dying in the streets. And both of these men thought it would be perfectly possible for them to die at any time. In less than 6 months, 18,000 people died in Paris of cholera. And Cooper couldn't get out of town, get away from it, because his wife was too ill to be moved. Morse refused to leave because he was out of money, and he was determined if it cost him his life, he was going to finish that painting before the Louvre closed for the summer in late August. Cooper came every single day to keep up Morse's courage, to keep him company. I could have written a whole book on that friendship and the interpretation of that painting beyond just the paintings that are in it, but how he peopled that gallery. And I don't know, we've all had the experience when we're away from our country or in some place very different, where you make a friendship that's different from any friendship you've ever made. You bond faster and for life. And this is a perfect example of that. And two of the most talented Americans who ever lived. And it seems incongruous that they were off in Paris and not back in the United States. But in fact, they were America in Paris in their eyes. They became more American, more patriotic than they had been before. Augustus St. Gaudens writes a wonderful thing, if I may just read this
sure.
to you. He said, "I belong in America. That is my home." And so much that he had found unbearable about America when he left, he now longed for. And he said he was unabashedly homesick, and that he was surprised to find out how much of an American I am, unquote. And he said, "I shall return a burning, hot-headed patriot." And that, I think, patriotism runs strong through this whole story in what they themselves wrote.
Yeah.
The doctors, they're not just bringing this medical training back so that they can be more celebrated as doctors. They're bringing it back for the benefit of their country, and said so.
Yeah, they come back and they write books, and they're teaching
and
other
teaching.
Schools how
and,
to
and
do
they,
this.
The teachers, they all, Emma Willard, who, of course, was the first American woman to champion higher education for women, was transformed by the experience and brought that back to her Emma Willard School, which is still there in Troy, New York. But the doctors brought it back. The artists came back to teach in the art schools. The architects came back to teach architecture in architectural schools. in a way, they all became teachers, and they're still teaching us with their story.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest this hour is Pulitzer Prize-winning author David McCullough. His new book is called The Greater Journey, Americans in Paris. So how much of this book took you back to Paris, and how much of the research did you do from here in the U.S.?
Most of the research was done here because the letters and diaries are all here. Mm-hmm. I did do research in Paris of the conventional kind, Bibliothèque Nationale and so forth. But mostly I went back to Paris about once a year for a couple of weeks just to walk the walk, just to soak it up in different seasons and to see how much I'd gotten wrong. After one visit, I came back and virtually rewrote the whole second chapter because I realized I didn't have it quite right. And I had many people who know Paris cold go over it and say, have I got it right? Is this, am I overstating this? Or one of the lessons of history, and certainly one of the lessons of life, is nothing much is ever accomplished alone. And the number of people who helped me with this book, helped me in so many ways, is considerable.
Is it actually easier to have that humility about your own work now that you've been doing this for decades than it was when you first started and maybe you weren't as confident in yourself?
Well, I've always felt with every project that I was embarking on a new journey, that I was embarking on a new adventure. I've never undertaken a subject about which I felt I was an expert. Mm-hmm. If I were an expert, I wouldn't want to write the book. It's the idea of how much I'm going to learn that's a big part of it. I guess that experience does make things easier. I've never considered myself working. This is what I do. This is what I want to do. I don't think of it as work. Work is helping to wash the dishes or something of that, doing income taxes. That's work. But this is, to me, a joy. I love to get up out of bed in the morning in order to get back to the project, get back to the detective case, which is in many cases, in many instances, that's the feeling. You're hot on a detective case.
What do you paint?
I do mostly still lifes and landscapes in watercolor, and I love to do it. I do paint in oil too, but I really love to get outdoors and on the scene. And I sometimes do scenes. I haven't done any for Paris for this book. But I sometimes go and do a sketch or a watercolor of settings in the books I have because it helps you to see better and to remember better. I tell people who want to become writers or who is trying to learn how to write, take a course in drawing or painting. Helps you to look at things and observe, and that's what writers have to do.
David McCullough's new book is called The Greater Journey, Americans in Paris. It is in bookstores now, and there are signed copies available at the Dallas Museum of Art gift store. David, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for making this hour.
Well, I've hugely enjoyed it. Thank you very much for including me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.